dear listeners. Welcome to another week of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast. I need to thank all of my listeners, each and every one of you, because the podcast has reached 25,000 downloads, and honestly, I couldn't have done it without you. So thank you, each and every one of you, for making this podcast an incredible and satisfying success. I need to thank each and every one of you who has left a rating and written a review, but as always, I would be ever so grateful if those of you who haven't yet left a rating or haven't written a review find it in your hearts to do so. Those ratings and reviews help others find us. This week, I interview the incredible Wayne Miller, and to say that he started life as a scientist would be very reductionist. I like to include a little blurb about my guest every week in the intro, but this week, I'm going to let Wayne describe who he is and just some of the adventures he's had in his life. Sometimes it's better to just let the guest tell you who they are. I loved our conversation because I love science, I love science magazines, and so it was just an absolute thrill to interview Wayne. So now, episode 121 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
Four Arrows and I have in common that we were pierced, although he did a piercing that was to hang. You know, your skin is sliced, a wood dowel is put through the holes. It's attached to a rope. In his case, he was lifted off the ground and hung. In my case, it was on my back, and I was pulling buffalo skulls around the circumference of the lodge. If you were to ask a Sundance chief, why do people do this? They would tell you to take on the pain of the community, to its supportive of being healthy, of having a healthy community.
As a human being, you know, if you were to go to a conference and you have to introduce yourself, or to a party or gathering and you're introducing yourself, how do you self-describe?
Well, there's an easy question, huh? You know, it's funny. I guess that depends on the audience, truth be told, because some audiences will want to know something about me and others something else. So the last time I gave a very large public talk was in Washington, D.C. in 2017. I was at the global conference of the National Association of Corporate Directors. And I started by saying I'm the son of a Marine. And if I'm a little intense, that's not a excuse. That's just the explanation. My father was in the South Pacific in World War II. And, you know, he wasn't storming beaches all the time because I probably wouldn't be here. But there's a certain grit that comes with having been raised in that household. And I do, in fact, think that explains some things. It's worth knowing as well that I am the son. My mother was one of the founders of the National Cancer Survivors Alliance, which back in the 1980s, predated Susan B. Komen and anything else. They were talking about nutrition for cancer patients, doing what I guess would be called focus groups in hospitals, which back in the 1980s was, you know, sort of crazy talk. So I have not fallen far from either of those trees. And that's probably useful to know, given that parents shape us so much. It's probably important to know I'm married almost 40 years. I have two daughters. I think if I had two sons, it might be different. I have a dog who I also love, and I make no public statement as to, on any given day, who I love more.
Sarah, of course, your daughter, has, over the course of my knowing her, alluded to some
ideas of who you are. And she's really suggested to me that you're very knowledgeable about nutrition and health and the body. And I guess, how did that happen? How did that journey happen?
So the journey started, the real answer to that question is that journey started when I was 16 and I went to college and found myself working in the lab of a guy who turns out to be a world famous neuroscientist. And so I was just given this opportunity to sort of explore and allow my mind to be as curious as it wanted to be. So I had this love of science and science research that, you know, when everyone else was figuring out what the dating scene was like, I wasn't doing that so much. When I was 18, I got a job working for a drug company doing brain research. I mean, I didn't have my undergraduate degree. You couldn't do that now. Like, that's crazy. And as long as I did what they wanted me to do, they paid for me to do whatever I wanted to do. So I was in this playground. And there was an experience I had, and I was very interested in what at the time was called split brain research. The notion that you have two hemispheres of the brain, they're connected by this fiber that transverses the brain on both sides of the cerebral cortex called the corpus callosum. And at the time, there had been 2,000 scientific articles written about the corpus callosum, and I read every single one. So I was very familiar at an early age with reading scientific literature. Interestingly enough, I was told by the PhD in my lab that the hard part was 90% of it was nonsense. And you not only had to figure out what the 10% was that you had to pay attention to, but then how to pay attention to it. It turns out nothing has changed. You know, nutrition is this complex topic because it doesn't fit well into the model that is called the gold standard in science. Should be more like bronze or, you know, fake gold, or they call it gold. And if you have only two variables that you're actually examining, it's spectacular. The problem is there's almost nothing in biology that actually works that way. And so it's the notion of creating cause and effect by examining the impact of two variables on one another, what we call science research that is published, that is the literature, it's the wrong tool for studying a multivariate environment. But that's what we got. So you have to wade through an astounding amount. I mean, you're going to come up, you do an experiment, you're going to come up with an answer. It's just not going to be an accurate representation of the natural environment because there's almost nothing nutritionally that is related to two variables. I mean, the simplest example of this is a lot of friends take supplements, and I keep telling them, it's not what you take, it's what you absorb. And, you know, as you get older, that becomes way more challenging. And that would be just one example. Absorption is a complicated arena by itself. So that's a long answer to a short question, maybe, huh?
Well, what I was going to point out is I think what makes it even more complex and dynamic is that every human being is different. And so what might be the right supplement for one person is not the right supplement for someone else. I mean, I know this because I know lots of people and I know lots of people taking different things, and every person's body is different, you know, depending on their history, the trauma they've suffered, the stories they tell themselves. Absolutely every single piece that is individual to a human being is going to affect how they absorb what they take in.
That's
and
right.
what resonates with them. So I actually am just still kind of agog that you went to college at 16.
Well, that falls under the column of things that are hard to explain, but I got out of high school in 3 years, and when I was in high school, they let me take college classes. So I had this unique experience when I was 14 of taking college classes and getting high grades. So, you know, the kind of anxiety that people have about going to college and, oh my God, I'm by myself, I'm out of my parents' house, how am I going to do? And there's a zillion distractions. I had already been past all that. And I was more in like, I could do any of this. And so that was a piece of it. I want to go back to the nutrition thing, because there's a term in systems biology, this study of complex adaptive systems, that's really very relevant, and it's called emergent properties. And the notion of an emergent property is not something I was trained in when I was in science. It's not something you learn when you study, you know, a doctor study medicine. It's not what they learn. And the notion is that while reductionist science, the tool we use to examine nature around us, seeks to sort of isolate the smallest components of something for the purposes of understanding how they work, there is a notion of emergent properties which says that's limited, because you have to study things the way they're designed for the environment they're designed in to understand them. It's a little bit like taking a light bulb apart and going, how does this thing make light? It's only in the context of it operating as a whole with a power source that goes, oh, now I get it. And, you know, most of science came up through anatomy, which was all learned on dead people. So, you know, they were missing something. Take the perspective that they were missing something, apply that lens to how we teach people in science how to think, and you end up with all kinds of problems. A simple example, the periodic table of elements. So, you know, someone won a Nobel Prize for putting that thing together. And early on, there were lots of holes and the vertical columns of things like, you know, fluorine and fluoride and chloride and bromine and iodine. They're called halides. They're all in the one vertical column. But they're all that entire organization is based on the neutral state that they're, you know, all their electrons that are supposed to be there, all the protons are there operating as they should. And it turns out, you know, there's five oxidative states of oxygen that we know of. It's the non-neutral state that have physiological activity. So we oriented people to the neutral state when it's the non-neutral state that's actually the relevant one, you know, where oxygen is +2 or -2 or +1, -1. And so we orient people to this framework that's entirely misses the point. You know, that's just one example. We're deep in it now.
Say, you know, your daughter has been a champion advocate for health in my body. And it's really interesting when you're taking that journey to hopefully finding equilibrium and wholeness, that, you know, the mainstream medical community has their kind of ideas about what is normal for everyone, but that's not true of every single person. So your daughter is indefatigable when it comes to trying to figure out what is going on with my body. I mean, she's always texting me or doing a deep dive for research. She's astonishing. And she actually just sent me this book called, or she told me to get this book called The Salt Fix. And it's the idea that more salt is good for some people, you know, that we've been told a low salt diet is the way to go. But in reality, the body has an immense capacity to regulate salt. And, you know, I've been having heart palpitations and issues for years. Every doctor I've gone to has said, I've never heard of this. I don't even know where to start. You know, I've had the EKGs, I've had everything. And then I started drinking more salt and my symptoms have almost pretty much gone away. And it's the amount of salt that, you know, some people would say, oh my God, what are you doing? But, you know, for my body, that's what it needs. And so I've really just been on this interesting journey of understanding that what Western medicine says is the average, I guess, for every human is not true. You know, each person is different. And I owe this to your daughter, that I'm feeling better, honestly. And I also try to emphasize on the show that, you know, medicine is not one's, it's not one size fits all. Yes, go to a Western med doc, but also get acupuncture, try Reiki, try whatever might resonate for you, osteopathy. I mean, and I don't know, would you advocate that? Of course, nutrition is so important.
A couple of things come to mind. One, the mathematics that is at the heart of Western reductionist science attempts to fit the patient to the curve. It's really important to sort of understand that. I mean, on the face of it, what's called, you know, a bell curve, a Gaussian curve, you know, there's this notion that two-thirds of it fits, 66% of it fits approximately in the middle. That leaves one-third on each side in total. And then the what's called the tails, you know, you could be four standard deviations, to use a term, off from the center. You know, in a nation of 335 million people, you're still going to have a couple of million people off on the edge. So doctors aren't trained to know anything about that. They are trained, in fact, to hit the average. So the math is all wrong of their approach. It may be helpful from an industrialized point of view in terms of population, but it's not very helpful for the everyone else for whom they struggle and struggle and struggle. There is a notion that, and some of this is, again, it's about their education. It's about the approach. It's about what they missed in terms of context, because what passes for medicine doesn't take context into account. And as far as I can tell, the only thing that doesn't live in context is God. Everything else is contextual. You know, everything is contextual. It's the environment that it's in that determines sort of how it works. And, you know, 45% of all proteins have this bizarre three-dimensional configuration. You've seen some of the pictures. And somewhere in the middle of that, there's a mineral, magnesium, boron, manganese. 45% of all proteins have a mineral. And if you're deficient in minerals, you're not going to have all those. So you're going to have some deficient protein complex. Oh, it'll do something, just not what it was designed to do if it had the mineral. So the first thing I ever, when I was doing health coaching, I don't do it anymore. When I was doing it, I would tell people, first thing is to remineralize. Because until you get your minerals up to snuff, and that is not a simple thing to do. Until you get them up to snuff, it's hard to sort of estimate what's really going on. There's several different ways one can remineralize. But you know, most Americans, and this has been well known for years, are deficient in most minerals. I mean, you can't eat food grown in soils deficient, because then the food doesn't chelate the minerals into the plant. And if you eat vegetables or food grown in deficient, whatever's fed those plants or animals, you're going to be deficient. It's very difficult to heal with that deficiency in place. So my wife and I got turned on to fulvic acid. And there's various forms of this stuff that we take that all the time, especially when you sweat. So when you sweat, it's really important to remineralize. I mean, I had a young woman that was referred to me, 27 years old, had lived on the street, you know, from the time of like age 11 to 21 or something, with all the trauma and craziness that goes along with it. She was sent to me because a common friend knew us, and she was diagnosed with MS at 27. And, you know, it's like getting a death sentence when you're 27. I mean, people with MS live a long life, but they, you know, are on drugs that are 35 to 50,000 a year, blah, blah, blah. I gave her particular type of mineral formulation. It's very interesting stuff, called Kintan water. It's extracted from photoplankton blooms. There's only a few of them in the world. It's been known for over 100 years. It so closely matches the mineral content of human blood that the French were using it for transfusions in World War I, direct transfusions. I'm like, what? I gave her a box of the stuff because someone had given it to me. And within 1 month of taking the sort of intense formulation of this stuff, 90% of her MS was gone. And I don't know which mineral or combination of minerals that was. So, you know, you will often find extraordinary results from just remineralizing. Science, we're taught all this stuff. Oh, there's magnesium and calcium and chloride and potassium, and it all has a charge on it. This was an interesting moment, by the way. We tend to think of those things when we're trained in science as transactional. Oh, calcium goes in, chlorine goes out, whatever. But what I learned along the way was that when I was a pharmacologist, pharmacology is the study of the carrier of the signal in terms of the charge. But the body works on signal processing. Lots of things can carry charge. And signal processing has math and syntax and grammar. And that was this, my brain kind of went, because all of a sudden you can begin to explain physiology in ways that you never could if you studied classical science. Classical science, they would always tell you, well, one day someone will explain Brownian movement, that, you know, stuff bumps into one another and shit happens. And I'm like, okay, well, I hope to meet that person one day. I never did. And it turns out it was entirely wrong and that they had missed the math. And so I got very deep into biophysics, because in biophysics, you're studying how charge affects these charged particles, and charge affects charge. Of course it does. If you conduct a negative space and a positive space, if you conduct them so that they will neutralize one another's charge. This, by the way, is the biophysics behind grounding or earthing. People know it as walking barefoot on the ground in the soil. Soil has a natural negative charge to it all over the planet, because the planet is struck by a 100 million volt strike of lightning about 1,000 times a second. And so when you walk barefoot in that space, you are having charged particles, electrons, come into your feet. So when you sleep with a grounding pad, for example, it's like taking a 7-hour antioxidant bath. You know, this is just it's just simple biophysics. It's just like engineering 101. But it's not how physicians are taught. It's a problem. You can build a healthcare system based on inadequately teaching people about nutrition and biophysics and expect to have something that makes sense. Let me take that one step further. Think about evolution for a second. Evolution is really a synonym for cooperation. Somehow my ancestors had to figure out how to cooperate with the environment they were in, or they wouldn't have made it. And let's take that down to a molecular level. The molecular cooperation between internal environment and external environment, there had to be a bridge that was reinforced behaviorally. That's what it had to do, or my ancestors wouldn't have made it. There is a technical term for that bridge of reinforcement between internal and external molecular environment. It's called food. And you can't ignore a fundamental pillar of evolution, as is done in medical education, and expect to come out with an infrastructure that's going to make much sense, because it's fundamentally anti-science. It's fundamentally ignoring what allowed the species to survive.
I'm just going to say that I'm a little kind of astonished right now, because you said chelation, and that's one of my favorite words. It's so beautiful. I think it's such an interesting and beautiful word. And then I was listening to you, and I was thinking, you know what other word I love? Or Brownian motion. I love that so much. And then you said it, and I thought, what? What is going on here? I agree with all of that. And I think, yeah, that's a whole other huge conversation. So I'm going to go to a simpler question. Okay. So did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like for your family?
I didn't. I grew up in what I suppose I would now call a middle-class Jewish household that didn't, other than eating bagels and salmon, that didn't mean very much to me, I have to admit. I never found a spiritual grounding in that space. I always wondered, it would always strike me as a little odd because I grew up on the East Coast and I would, to this day, most of my friends would say, oh yeah, I'm Jewish, but I'm not observant. And I'm like, what does that mean? How isn't that the entire purpose of sort of the mythology and the narrative of, well, there was this guy, Abraham, and turns out he was very observant. How do you emulate that without being observant? I don't even know what that means. So yeah, my spiritual development was guided by other things other than religion. I will say, they're just totally from left field. I recently got turned on to a quote from the Talmud, which I don't really know that much about. It's sort of the narrative of learned men from a very long time ago, rabbis. And there was one that really spoke to me. And I'm just going to read it. It says, do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. And that's like the most profound thing I had heard in a very long time. And it speaks to me having spent a lot of time in healthcare and healthcare informatics and data sciences and having walked away from it and, having lots of, conflicting feelings about having walked away, but not having been comfortable walking away. So this spoke to me dramatically. Let me begin with...
I did want to tell you that... So I understand you know four arrows.
Yeah.
And I just have to tell you that, I kept seeing his book everywhere, this latest book. So I finally bought it and I started reading it. And I said, I'm going to reach out to him and just... I don't know him at all, and you know what? He got back to me immediately and was so kind and so considerate and just really lovely. And we had a great conversation. He did it in his swim trunks, which I thought was hilarious. And then, a few weeks later, after I produced the episode, I go to see Sarah and we're having a conversation. And I said, you know what? I just produce this episode with this gentleman I think you'd find interesting. His name was Four Arrows. And she said, stop. Stop. My dad is good friends with him. And I said, what? Yeah. What are you talking about? It blew my mind. I couldn't even understand that. So I just love that connection.
Shouldn't have drank when you said that. Okay, so you asked about miracles, and I'll, instead of working from the front back, I'll work from the back front, most recent. So Four Arrows and I are Sundance brothers, and we attend a Cree Mati Sundance up in Alberta. We've done this for several years. I think he also went to Lakota Sundances, was invited to do that many years ago. Our Sundance chief is a man in his mid-70s. hanging out with this guy is like taking a hike with Yoda. It's a miracle that I was born in a row house in Philadelphia. It's 18 feet wide. There's a 40 or 50 of them. That's a block. And White Standing Buffalo, AKA Tom, was born in northern Saskatchewan in the bush. Didn't come out of the bush until he was 14. So he grew up in all the old ways. And for me to have this man in my life is just astounding. I met him in an experience. This is a little bit much. Invoked by an advanced biophysics device 7 years before I met him in person. And When I met him in person the first time, I knew it was him. It was the man that I had seen in this vision. He pulled me aside within a couple of days of having met him, and he said to me, "You know, Wayne, you were born and raised in a language and culture of nouns. And I was born and raised in a language and culture of verbs." I had to think about that for a moment, because no one has ever boiled it all down to that one phrase. You know, it's like, holy shit. You know, a noun is something that we understand because it is distinguished and separate from everything else. A verb is something that connects things in action. So it's a whole. You know, I've known from having studied neuroscience early on that language literally shapes brain form and function. And our brains were shaped along a theme of identifying everything by its separateness. His was shaped by identifying how everything is connected. Wow. And participating in Sundance has been, you know, I mean, from being a scientist to the latter part of my career was spent as a finance guy. So I consulted on well over $100 billion around the world for large companies and countries. So I have this experience in two domains. It's not clear that you need your right brain for either of them. And Sundance has been and continues to be profound in a way that is difficult to capture. My indigenous friends, the ones born into a family that honored what they call the Red Road, you know, the ways that their ancestors lived, have this gift that is stunning. And I'm so grateful for it. My life is immeasurably richer for having had the exposure. Four Arrows and I have in common that we were pierced, although he did a piercing that was to hang. You know, your skin is sliced, a wood dowel is put through the holes. It's attached to a rope. In his case, he was lifted off the ground and hung. In my case, it was on my back, and I was pulling buffalo skulls around the circumference of the lodge. If you were to ask a Sundance chief, why do people do this? They would tell you to take on the pain of the community, to its support of being healthy, of having a healthy community. So when I had this experience a few years ago, it's very interesting. There's no pain. You're in some other place, like you're just in another place. Two eagle wings were placed in my hands. I don't mean someone cut off the wing of an eagle, or feathers that are put together, you know, and wrapped with sinew. And Sundance chief says, "Remember why you're doing this." What came out of my mouth when I started is about 120 pounds of bone that you're moving along the dirt was, "I give myself to you, Lord. I give myself to you." I didn't know that was going to come out of my mouth. I didn't practice it. It just came out. And the interesting part of that experience, I mean, the whole thing was interesting, but when I was done walking the circumference of the lodge, they unhooked me, and my first thought was, wow, that's what crucifixion is all about. My Christian friends are like, whoa. And I didn't know that before I did that exercise. But isn't that the whole thing? When my Christian friends talk about Christ died to take on your sins. And, you know, when you read the book, Biography of a Yogi, he's like, oh, yeah, that's what the advanced people do. They take on all the bad karma. They just take it from you. And I had that experience several years ago for the first time when I went to see Amma. Some people know her as the Hugging Saint. You know, this kind of round-ish Indian woman from Kerala who was known for being one of those advanced souls that come down. I don't know why so many of them show up in India. I don't know. She was here a week after my wife was diagnosed with stage 3 of breast cancer. This talk about miracles. So we went to go see her. We waited for hours. You go up on stage. She hugs you. She took my head, put it to her chest, and kissed my forehead. As you might imagine, you know, Janet and I have been married, I don't know, 20 years then. I adore my wife. I did back then. And, you know, you get a diagnosis like that, it scares the living bejesus out of you. And I didn't hear any giant sucking sound at the time. but I will tell you that she sucked the capacity for me to worry out of my soul. And it's never really come back. So I could look at things without emotional involvement in a way that would have been inconceivable to me at the time. Yeah, the experience with Alma was, you know, I'd never met an advanced soul before. Incredible. I mean, I can't explain that in any way. So the story about what made you go see Alma is stunning in and of its own right, because I just finished a book called The Sign and the Seal written by Graham Hancock. And I didn't know who he was. Fascinating individual, turns out. And he was a journalist for The Economist in East Africa. And he heard this myth about how in the Bible, there's this thing that holds the Ten Commandments. And, it then just disappears from the Bible and it's never mentioned again. Like this really important thing in the entire biblical narrative. And it's like, yep, it's gone. No one ever says, I wonder what happened to that thing. So in East Africa, there's this myth that somehow it was carried down through Egypt and down into Ethiopia. And it was left in this town, Urim, I think. I'm not sure that's exactly how you say it, Urim, Ethiopia. And at the very end of the book, he goes to this place and there's this ancient Christian Coptic sect. And there's a guy who's known as the Keeper of the Ark. And he's the only one allowed in this building. And he burns myrrh and incense. And he had a picture of this guy. And you could look into this guy's eyes and go, something's different over there. When I saw a picture of Alma, she had the same eyes. And it was published in the Seattle Times the week my wife was diagnosed. And I went, we got to go see her. So this really bizarre sequence of things occurred. I don't know other than to say I was being guided by something. Yeah, I've had moments like that. After seeing Alma, I came home, I had this experience, and I made a pledge. You saved my wife, I'll be at your service forever. And a lot of things in my life unfolded that were consistent with that. And I can't say that I went along with all of them, because I don't know if the ones I didn't go along with, I don't know how they worked out. But I had some pretty, pretty remarkable moments. After I left science, I was in finance, and I was the developer of the first pension fund fiduciary training program in the United States. This is where I go back to, you know, me being the son of a Marine. So we wrote this thing based off of honor. And a lot of people were like, wait, I don't know where you think you're going to get with this in business in the U.S., because that's not really part of the lexicon. I was in Los Angeles giving a talk on what we had created. There was a woman sitting in the front row. I don't know who she was. Turns out she was the CEO of something called Financial Executives International, the largest association of finance officers in the United States. And she came up to me and said, this has to be in every CFO's toolbox. So they put us on a webcast. And I found myself elevated into conversations that I could never have imagined. Then the same woman from the World Bank called me and said, hey, you know, people from the government of Dubai called me. They want me to come over. She was a little bit concerned about being a woman in an Arab country. Dubai doesn't really have those challenges, but this was way back in 2007. It was a little different then, maybe. And so I went in her stead. Someone else from the World Bank invited me to a conference, and this is what I'm getting to, a miraculous moment, invited me to a conference of pension reform in the Middle East and North Africa. 13 Muslim and Arab countries were invited. And it was sponsored by the World Bank, all on pension reform. I had created this fiduciary thing in the U.S. I got invited. You know, I was the only American in the room. I had an amazing moment at the conference. I was at the conference. The conference had just come to an end, and two women from the Lebanese Social Security system came up to me. One of them looked at me. The other couldn't look at me. And she said to me, "How could you?" This is in December of, I want to say 07, I think. It was right after Israel bombed the daylights out of Beirut and killed 1,000-some-odd people in the bombing. I instantly knew what she was referring to. You know, I'm in this place where I'm surrounded by these officials from 13 Arab governments. I had nothing to say to her. I didn't know what to say. Nothing came out of me. I didn't know what to say. And so I went back to the room. The conference is over. I'm checking the room, the safe in the room. And, you know, I put my watch in there and some other stuff. And, you know, I'm checking the little lip around the safe and I find two very nice diamond earrings. And I thought, well, I'm going to be the honest American here. I'm going to turn them into the hotel. These are, I don't know what they were worth. I assumed they were real diamonds because they were in the safe and someone had left them there. I don't know, $5,000-$10,000, who knows? And so I take them to the front desk and say, "Hey, you know, someone left these diamonds in the safe. You should contact them and figure out who it was, get it back to them." And while I'm there at the front desk, I see these two women from Lebanon that I had nothing to say to. And I want to read this passage. I keep this on my desk. I'm going to read the passage out of this book. Kind of thing, these aphorisms, you study it word by word like a meditation. "When a man becomes steadfast in his abstention from harming others, then all living creatures will cease to feel enmity in his presence." I studied that for days and days and days before going to this conference. I see these two women from Lebanon sitting on the sofa, kind of in this area off to the side of the front desk. I go up to the woman who talked to me. I grab her hand. And I said, "I just want you to know that some of us care for your children as we care for our own." To this day, it's still poignant. She started crying. I started crying. The other woman started crying. And you could feel the bridge being built. And in my whole life, there may never have been as important in a moment as that.
These stories, and I think what was really beautiful for me in your story with the diamond earrings and the two women was you used the word bridge with what happened between you, and I just thought, oh, that harkens back to the bridge that you were talking about earlier in the conversation with, in terms of evolution and molecules, and you know, they always say as above, so below, and The molecules conversation, I call it conversation, bridge conversation, which allowed for evolution and that, and groups of peoples early on created relationship, conversation, bridges with other groups of peoples, with the environment around them. And then there you are doing it again and using that word with those two women. And what's really interesting for me in that is, for me, that's the evolution towards understanding other humans, having compassion for them, empathy, so that we don't bomb them, so that we don't kill them, so that we can move together as a species, as a whole, is going to be through creating those bridges that you were talking about. I just thought that was really interesting you used that word. And I had this light bulb moment where, oh, yes, that's how we're going to evolve. You know, whether it's culturally, you know, physically, who knows? I would like to develop gills someday so that I can go in the ocean and, you know, I will be regressing a little bit, I suppose. But I do think that the use of that word was really evocative for me. So thank you.
Yeah, it's you know, my indigenous friends, it's natural to them. And not so much. And, you know, I've got a lot of Democratic friends. I've got a lot of Republican friends. I'm sometimes amazed that any of them tolerate me because I'm usually like a pox on both their houses. But I'm always trying to figure out how to build a bridge because, as it's often said, there's a lot more that connects us than is different. I appreciate that there's an astounding amount of noise. Our culture is excellent at creating noise. It's not really that helpful. There's an astounding amount that's built on creating noise. And it takes you away from having those moments where you go, geez, how do I build a bridge there? Noise is no substitute.
No, I always think of Shakespeare and that phrase, sound and fury signifying nothing. That's what it seems like we're surrounded by all the time. These empty, almost vacuous, but pointed and toxic, to me, I'm going to use the word ravings because sometimes they just don't seem like they make any sense. They're certainly not contributing to any sort of wholesome, healthful conversation. But our society seems like it's gotten addicted to, clicks or likes or just being noticed so that ratifies your existence as a human being on this planet. Those clicks, those likes, those approvals from other human beings, no matter what you're saying, seems to be current. It's the currency these days that people use to justify their existence, to say that I am lovable, I am worth something. And it's not helpful. I mean, I can say that. That's the understatement of the century. And I wish that people would understand that. I mean, truly, we have more in common than a lot of people would like to admit. I'm like you. I grew up in a Democratic household. I have Republican friends, I have Democratic friends, but I'm in the middle somewhere because I understand that one side has positive attributes, the other side has positive attributes. And if we could just collaborate and have a conversation and understand that, demonizing the other isn't going to help anything, kind of just shuts everything off, which, for me, your statement on your Indigenous friends and their life is lived in terms of verbs. I find that really beautiful because there's movement in that. There's a lot of movement. There's the inhalation and the exhalation of the breath where there's movement. And so, if you live your life in terms of there's always going to be movement instead of shutting down the conversation, I think we could actually build some bridges. And stop living in this kind of static environment where you never get any traction or movement forward. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. I'm going to include a link to the book that Wayne references, How to Know God, The Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali. This is the book that Wayne references when he has that interaction with the women in Jordan. There'll be a link to the book under the episode show notes on the website. I need to thank Wayne for taking time out of his life to have this lively and really fun conversation. I enjoyed every minute and I had no idea what was coming next. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, Winnie the Moog, Philip Rice, Music L Files, Frank Schroeder, Sasha End, and Stephen O'Brien. For complete attribution, please see the Bite Sized Blessings website at BiteSizedBlessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to playlists, music, artists, and art I think will lighten and brighten your day. You'll also notice, dear listeners, we've reached season 13 of the podcast. I really can't believe it, and I'm so grateful to you and my guests for allowing me to do this labor of love and bring these stories to the world. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Wayne. Seek to build bridges. Not only will those bridges help the human race evolve into compassion and empathy for the other, but a bridge built every day can build relationship, true friendship and love between all of us. And we need more bridges. We need more conversation and commonality in this world. We need to know the other, get to understand them, find out what makes them tick, who they are as human beings. The media does a great job these days demonizing the other. But if you go out, like Wayne does, with a pure heart and with belief in other people, I'm sure all of us, working together, we can make this world a better and shinier place.